Hi everyone, this is Dr. Cheryl Silman, and thank you for joining me today for another opportunity to have a great conversation about a topic that is so vitally important for all of us to really understand. Before we jump into things, I do want to invite everybody listening, especially for new listeners, to go over to my website, whatwomenmustknow.com, and visit me over there. I have special reports that will be sent to you, and as well, you will be able to get the archived shows if you happen to miss any of them, which you never want to do. And also, my Facebook page is another place to go. Like me over there. I post on a daily basis great information, and it's also a place where you can get the archived shows that I do on a weekly basis. So please go over, keep learning, keep growing. As I like to say, this program is all about empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. So today we're going to be diving deep into a topic that really has been in the news lately. I think we are going to be discovering that there's so much we've been hearing that's not true, and that is the world of vaccinations and autism. If you've been hearing about this, if you formed a decision about it one way or another, I just implore you to listen with an open mind, because the information and the research and the knowledge you will learn today will open up possibilities of seeing what is really going on, lifting the veil, as I like to say. So today's guest is a really inspiring person. He is Kent Heckenlively, who is a science teacher and attorney and founding contributing editor of Age of Autism. During college, Kent worked for the U.S. Senator Pete Wilson, and in law school, he was a writer and editor of the school's Law Review and spent his summers working for the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco. His previous book, Plague, written with Dr. Julie Mikovits, a 20-year government scientist and former head of the Lab of Antiviral Drug Mechanisms at the National Cancer Institute, is one of the best-selling virus books of the past 20 years. And Kent has written the latest book called Inoculated, How Science Lost Its Soul in Autism. And his research reveals how the Centers for Disease Control deliberately chose to inaccurately report test results and showed a distinct correlation between the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine and increased autism statistics, and showed a lack of courage by those who could have spoken up in the early 2000s when indicators began to surface, but instead stayed silent or deliberately perverted the truth, and have resulted in an entire generation of autism-disabled children and a fast-rising tide of more. So this is a really important conversation, and it is my pleasure to welcome Kent Heckenlively to the show today. Hello, Kent.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and I just really want to personally thank you for the tremendous amount of work. This is a huge book that you wrote, I'm sure. I guess you got experience when you were doing the Law Review to be able to put something like this together, because it's a work of determination and love, no doubt, because it's so well resourced and researched. So first of all, thank you for doing that. I know how much time it takes when you're writing a book and how much passion you have to put into it to make it possible. And especially one like this, which is really, it really is lifting the veil on this whole topic of vaccinations and their relationship to autism, which is denied out there when we're dealing with the media all the time. So, you know, Kent, I would like to start this conversation by asking you how you became so passionate about this topic.
Well, you know, I think in reading my background, you can see that I'm pretty much a straight arrow, goody-two-shoes, Dudley-do-right kind of guy. That's just the way I am, and, you know, I'm not a person who's in trouble. I'm not a person who is unconventional in most of the ways that you think like somebody who would end up like this is. So, you know, I met my wife. We dated for about a year and then got married. And just, you know, she's a speech therapist. I was an attorney. And then I became a science teacher because I really, you know, love sharing information with people. And it's a very positive life experience to be a teacher. And, you know, then we had our kids, and our first child, Jacqueline, when we look back on it, we think that she was vaccine injured at 6 months. What happened was she went off with breast milk about a week or two later. She got her 6-month series of shots, and then probably about 3 to 4 weeks after that, she started having her first head bobs, which were indicative of later diagnosed seizure disorder about 3 months later. And then at the age of 3 was diagnosed with autism. So, you know, at that time I'd heard about the issue of vaccines and neurological problems. And probably like most of your listeners, I thought that it was just kind of a crazy idea. I thought, okay, you know, I drew an unlucky card in the genetic lottery. And then my son came along. He's now 16 years old. And what happened with him was really interesting because for reasons unrelated to autism, we kept him on a hypoallergenic milk formula until he was about 15 months old. And I think that that's a part of this puzzle. But it got kind of expensive. So at 15 months, we switched him back to a regular cow-based milk formula. And I actually took my son to his 18-month checkup. And because I thought that pediatrician had missed something at my daughter's 6-month checkup, my son Ben was run through a full developmental checkup. He passed with flying colors, 15, 20 words, looking appropriately. Everything's great. He gets his shots. 3 days later, my wife says to me, you know, Ben has stopped talking, and he started pounding his head on the floor. And I just thought, my God, we were just at the doctor's. Everything was fine. How could this be? And that's when it dawned on me that it was the vaccines. And luckily, through the grace of God, I found out about the gluten casein-free diet. That's where you take them off of all cow's milk-based formulas. You take them off of wheat. And after 12 days of my 18-month-old son, at that time being mute, he said his first word again. And I always say it was as if we caught him as he was falling into the abyss of autism. And within about a year, he'd caught up in language. And here's my wife, a speech therapist, so she's a trained observer for language acquisition. And after about 2 years, all of his sensory problems went away. So he entered kindergarten as a normally developing 5-year-old. And then, you know, he's 16 years old now. He's on the track team. He's a great student, got a lot of friends. He's got a great sense of humor. And I have a daughter who has trouble walking, and she has seizures, and she can't speak, and she's in diapers. And, you know, I know that there's a person in there who's trapped in her body, and, you know, maybe it's a person of normal intelligence. I think it is. She's a person of normal intelligence. But there's absolutely no way to tell that at this point. So I know that it's not something just genetic. I know that it's something environmental. And I think that my eyes were really opened to it because I felt like I had there was a moment of clarity and a moment of choice. You know, I took my son to his 18-month checkup. I was there when he got his developmental checkup. I saw that he was completely normal. Within a few days, he was not normal. And then I got him back. And so, to me, I just felt like it was one of those moments when God taps you on the shoulder and says, you know, this is your mission. You can't deny it. And, you know, I always say that someday I'm going to die and face God. And when he asks me what I did during this crisis, I want to make sure I have a good answer.
Well, what a story. I'm sure you're dealing with lots of parents, because this is such a passion of yours, who have children who've been vaccine injured. What's the effect in a family with a child like your daughter? I mean, she must take a tremendous amount of care. You have to put her in a special educational facility. What goes on with parents who have to help these children?
You know, maybe in a sense I was lucky. My mom was a very severe diabetic, and I had a father who was just, you know, an angel to my mother. And so I've dealt with the experience of very severe illnesses in people. And so, you know, I say whatever you are, if your relationship has weaknesses, it may tear you apart. If your relationship is very strong, like it is with my wife and I, you just continue to be strong. And so I've kind of seen, and I think it's like a lot of things people have in life. When you have the unexpected tragedies or hardships happen, you know, you have a choice. You either become strong or you fall apart.
Yeah, you know, I know single parents who are dealing with several children with autism. It's such a challenge for people in dealing with children, who, especially if they're severely vaccine injured. It's, you know, there's a lot of stresses that go on in a family. How's your daughter now, by the way? So she's 19 or so?
She's going to be 19 tomorrow. You know, she, thankfully, the tantrum and screaming times are gone. She seems pretty happy. We have a very loving home. We did the Sunrise program for many years, which is about, you know, pretty much love and acceptance. And you know, we're living a life, and it's okay. And, you know, I'm so happy that I have a normally developing son. So, you know, I say I get to see, you know, I live the American dream in one side of my life, and I live the American nightmare in the other side of my life. Mm. So, you know, what I try to do is I try to be strong. I try to, you know, accept the good and fight the bad. Because one of the things I just have to say out there is that what the parents of autistic children are going through today is absolutely unprecedented in history. And that's why I have a lot of sympathy for, you know, people who, you know, we haven't yet cracked this issue, is because when you think about it, I mean, you know, generally when we think of like a parent with a child who's, you know, got a terrible disease, cancer, diabetes, you know, what have you, you know, they don't find the medical system and the media against them. I mean, it's remarkable, because here we are living the lives of saints with our children very severely injured, who need enormous care, and yet we're savaged in the media. The Boston Globe just came out, had an article in which the writer said that he thought that people who question vaccines should be hung. And you know, I just find myself saying, who are you? I mean, you know, do these people have souls? So, you know, I've spent 15 years now in this area and uncovered a lot of very troubling information. But I say to myself, okay, look, if you're somebody who hasn't even bothered to, you know, read one of my books or to look at the movie Vaxxed, From Cover Up to Catastrophe, if you haven't bothered to, you know, listen to my side of this issue, I say, fine. Well, then you tell me why, you know, people like me, I'm 53 years old, I never knew an autistic child. And right now, you know, I've got three autistic kids on my street, and it's not a long street. You know, it's a couple blocks long. And so I find myself saying, you know, I really think that I'm onto something. I think our community is onto something. I think that this is really an unprecedented evil, which is allowing this to take place. You know, I'm trained as a science teacher and a lawyer, so, you know, I'm not one who will commonly use words like evil. But it's the only name I have for it when the scientists at the CDC do the research. They come up with good research plans, and that's what my book Inoculated is about. And then when they get the data back and it shows that there's a problem with vaccines, they cover it up. And it really is that simple. And so I think that a lot of people in our community have felt that what we simply needed to do was we needed to get the medical community to pay attention to us, and then everything would be fine. And what you have to finally come to is the point which is those who are at the very top who are controlling this situation, they know what we know. And so it really is a war for the future of humanity. It's that simple.
Yeah, so why don't we start by sharing some of what you uncovered or some of the research that you did or that's starting to be available about this vaccine story, especially for those people who maybe are sitting on the fence, maybe don't have a clue about what the problem is. Is there a problem with vaccines? Or those that have absolute certainty that they're totally safe. Let's start there by looking at what you written about that causes great alarm in this world where we have been taught, and we hear it almost on a daily basis, how imperative it is for vaccines. And it's not just for children, we have to say. A friend of mine went in to get his annual checkup, and immediately they wanted to give him a vaccine for pneumonia and for shingles, which he denied. He said, "Are you kidding me?" But that was just immediately offered to him as soon as he stepped into that doctor's office.
What I think I really bring to this is my training as an attorney, because I always like to look at how systems are set up. Now, I really come from a law family. My dad is an attorney. My brother's an attorney. We always joke that our dog would become an attorney.
If they would let him in law school, he probably would.
Yeah. You look at systems, and, what I really have always highly valued is the legal system of checks and balances. I mean, this is something that's really in my DNA. And so what really got me thinking, first of all, when I started looking into this, was to find that in 1986, President Reagan signed and a Democratic Congress passed the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act. And what that act did was it removed childhood vaccines from the regular civil courts and put them in this special so-called vaccine court. Now, the rules of evidence are very different in vaccine court. And let me just sort of paint the picture. And this is something that anybody can research on their own. They'll find it out. So let's say tomorrow morning you're cooking up some toast and your toaster catches fire and burns down half your kitchen. Okay, you can sue the manufacturer of the toaster. And in suing the manufacturer, they have to disclose to you all of the complaints they've ever gotten about toasters catching fire. You can depose any of the engineers who worked on the toaster design. You can basically get all the information you need, and they have to turn it over to you legally, and then that's what you walk into a court of law with. Okay, nothing even remotely similar exists in vaccine court. First of all, you can't sue the manufacturer of the vaccine. They have total immunity, okay? You cannot get any documents from them. You cannot depose any of the scientists who developed the vaccine. Supposedly, we have this thing called the Vaccine Safety Database, which was what they created when they created this law. But you can't get access to it. So you are at a complete disadvantage, okay? So one of the things that I did in putting the book together was I thought, okay, any rational person who's not involved in this issue would normally want to say, like, okay, Ken, I understand you don't like vaccines. I understand that there's this vaccine court. Well, why don't you go and talk to somebody who works for the court and somebody who's studied the court, okay? So I went and interviewed one of the judges in this vaccine court. He was actually the chief judge for many years. And I asked him whether the court system was working. And he basically read me chapter and verse of all the ways that it's not working. And then when I asked him the ultimate question, I said, well, do you think that this court should be abolished and all of this simply put back into the regular traditional court system, he said, I don't feel qualified to answer that question. And so, you know, I mean, it, I kind of felt like I was talking to one of the generals who fought the Vietnam War, who kind of, you know, had his own sense of honor, which is like, I'll tell you everything that was wrong with the way we fought the Vietnam War, but I won't say whether I think the war should have been fought or not. So I went from that chief justice to a professor at Stanford Law School, who's one of the few academics who had studied the court. And the reason she'd studied the court is she had always heard that the vaccine court was working really well. And so she says, you know, I've heard that, but I can't find any information on it. So she was actually researching, you know, these alternative courts that people are using these days. And so she wanted to find out if it was working. And she found that there were two reasons why they put the court together. One was the speed recovery to the parents of vaccine-injured children. It wasn't supposed to take any longer than 240 days. She found that the average claim is now settled in 5 years, which is much longer than the regular court system, and it was supposed to remove the anger from the system. And she said, okay, so it's not getting quick recovery to the parents, and nobody's happy with it. So I asked her the same question. I said, okay, so actually in your published articles, you say the vaccine court should not serve as a model for any other alternative courts. Do you think the court should be abolished and just return this whole mess to the civil court system? And she said, I don't feel qualified to answer that question. And, you know, I just want to hit my head against the wall because I'm thinking, if I'm talking to the chief justice of the vaccine court and I'm talking to a Stanford law professor and nobody can tell me that this is a good system, you know, I just wonder, why is there all this animosity towards people like me who are raising questions? I mean, you know, my expectation in interviewing the chief justice of this chief special master of this vaccine court and a Stanford law professor, I was expecting them to tell me, you know, the you know, 8 ways from Sunday that this is a great system. And they absolutely did not do that. So I start with that as sort of my premise, that this is a terrible thing we've done. If we had never signed that bill, and it was actually kind of interesting to go and look at the historical record, because actually when President Reagan was considering it, his own Justice Department, in the person of John Bolton, who later went and became U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton and the Justice Department said, don't sign this law. And then actually Reagan, in his own signing statement, said, I am signing this law with significant reservations because I don't think it has a proper system of checks and balances. And I'm hoping that the next Congress will fix those problems. And so, you know, I look at the historical record and I find myself going like, my God, you know, when you go back in the historical record and you see like people were really worried about this. And now, you know, if you bring up vaccine injury, I mean, you know, even the UFO abductees make fun of vaccine safety people. You know, it's like we've got a third head growing out of our shoulders.
Why do you think it was passed? Do you think it was because the pharmaceutical industry had a great influence?
Yeah, you know, it was really interesting. What was happening was that, and this is all in the, you know, law journal articles of Nora Freeman Engstrom, the Stanford law professor, and it was really simple. There was the DPT vaccine, which was killing and maiming children, and it was a huge problem. At one point, one of the heads of the pharmaceutical companies said, our potential liability is 200 times our yearly sales of this vaccine. So they really were in a tough situation. But what happened as a result of it is that vaccines went from being you know, not really money makers for the pharmaceutical companies to being enormous money makers. And what happened was you had a situation where in the 1980s, you really had vaccines being not that bad. They did not seem to be causing that much harm. Basically, what you had was you had, I think, about 16 doses of five different vaccines before the age of five, with the majority of those coming after the age of three. Right now, what we have, and with the majority of those coming just before you go to kindergarten, I mean, that's the idea. Well, now you've got 49 doses of 16 different vaccines, with about 25 of those coming in the first year of life. Well, when you go to the biology textbooks, what you find is that the human immune system is not even really functioning properly until about the age of three or four. So why the hell are we giving vaccines to children with immature immune systems who, if there is anything okay about vaccines, they can't benefit from it? It's totally insane.
It is totally insane, and we're so locked into this brainwashing, which really is what has happened. You know, I want to ask you, when we talk about this vaccine injury court, there's some really troubling stories about people. Can you talk a little bit more about how you qualify, what you have to demonstrate to get any compensation for a severely injured child from vaccines? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so first of all, there's a three-year statute of limitations, but it's not a three-year statute of limitations from when you find out, oh my God, my child was vaccine injured. It's from when the injury took place. So here I was, you know, my child was damaged at 6 months, and, you know, it wasn't until my child was like 4 years old that I really knew that all of this was going on. I applied, and they said, too bad, you're out of luck. You're outside the statute of limitations. No doctor, you know, no neurologist ever even hinted that this might be a vaccine problem, even though you can go on to all of these vaccine inserts, and seizures are a potential side effect of vaccines. So that's really bad. What you have is you have a situation where you just can't get any information. I mean, you can't get any information from the companies that made the thing. You can't get any doctors to testify for you because they're worried that they're going to lose their license. And you know, this vaccine safety database, you can't get into. I mean, you know, it's amazing to me because they have locked up this information tighter than the hacking codes used by the CIA. I mean, it's – and I find myself going, like, who's the enemy in this? I mean, I can understand the CIA hiding hacking codes because we got enemies out there. But, you know, I really don't think I'm the enemy. You know, I want to have, you know, children be safe and children be healthy. And this is vitally important information that we get, and it's being denied to us. And, you know, we're told just go away, trust us. And, you know, throughout history, we found that when there have been powerful, influential individuals who say trust us, those are the people you should trust the least.
You know, I think we should emphasize that the drug companies do not pay any amount of money to any parent who has demonstrated that their child was injured through vaccines. Can we talk a little about that? Who really pays for it? And how much has been paid out? And how many people who apply actually make it to the end point where they are, you know, they receive some sort of compensation?
So here's the thing. So basically, every time somebody gets a vaccine, 75 cents goes into this vaccine injury compensation fund, okay? So since 1989, when the court was put together, they have essentially paid out, I think, think somewhere in the neighborhood of $3.4 billion with a B, in vaccine injury claims. So even though there's this terrible system, I think that most people would be surprised to find out that $3.4 billion or more has been paid out. There's something else that was really interesting in my conversation with the chief special master of the vaccine court. And because we have, there has been law review articles published in the PACE Environmental Law Journal by some good friends of mine. And what they actually did was they went through the cases that had been compensated in the vaccine court, and they found 83 cases in which one of the injuries alleged was autism, and those people had been compensated, okay? So you've got the government saying, we've never paid out for any vaccine injuries which included autism. Well, that's just a lie. So what was really interesting in talking to this chief special master was I said, you know, there have been reports that the vaccine injury compensation has given compensation to people for autism. What do you have to say about that? What is your comment on that? And so he says, well, he says, it's absolutely wrong to say that we have compensated people for autism caused by vaccines. I said, oh, okay. He says, here's what we have done from the earliest stages of the vaccine compensation program. We have always acknowledged that vaccines can cause encephalopathy, which is brain swelling. And we have always believed that one of the injuries as a result of encephalopathy is autism. So we have compensated people for vaccine injuries which cause encephalopathy and cause autism as one of the damages. And, you know, I'm just, again, I'm wanting to pound my head against the wall because I'm saying, I'm sorry, to John Q. Public, you just said vaccines cause autism. Yeah, there's the encephalopathy, the brain swelling. And then, you know, I asked him, okay, how often is encephalopathy diagnosed? You know, he couldn't really give me an answer on that. And I'm saying, so you have no problem saying that vaccines cause encephalopathy and one of the damages of encephalopathy is autism. Is that right? Yeah, I agree with that. That's the way you should say it. You know, I wanted to run my head through a wall because I'm saying that should be the lead story on ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, Fox, everybody. And, you know, I can't get arrested by saying that. And I'm saying to myself, you know, look, here's all the information, you know. And the thing that composes the bulk of my book, Inoculated, is the story of the CDC whistleblower, Dr. William Thompson, who worked at the Vaccine Safety Division of the CDC, and they covered up information showing a link between the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine and the development of autism. How do I know that this story is true? Because he turned federal whistleblower. He turned over more than 10,000 pages of documents to the office of Congressman William Posey, Republican, Florida. In writing my book, what I did was I applied to the office of Congressman Posey for access to the documents, and I was granted those documents, access to those documents. So I wrote my book based on documents I received from Congress of this incredible cover-up at the CDC, which persists to this day.
There's something I don't understand about this William Thompson story. So he's the whistleblower. He revealed how the CDC and the vaccine department, I guess you would call it, you know, fudged statistics, massaged them, did whatever they could do to make it look like vaccines were working and safe. Why is he still there? And if it's such a huge issue and he's so passionate about it, why doesn't he just quit the CDC and come out and, you know, be a witness?
It's a great question. So let me talk a little bit about what we have been doing and trying to make happen with our congressional leaders, with our national leaders. So when you become a federal whistleblower, the deal that is struck is you will have federal protection unless you speak out publicly before Congress calls you, okay? So he has to be called by the House Government and Oversight Reform Committee under Congressman Jason Chaffetz. He came out as a whistleblower in August of 2014. And I really figured at that time, that's when everything blows. To me, that was like the autism Watergate moment. And I thought, finally, something's going to happen. Well, 6 months passed, and still the media wasn't covering it, and that's when I sort of took it upon myself, and I said, well, if nobody else is going to tell this story, I'm going to tell the story. So I called up Dr. Brian Hooker, who is the scientist to whom Dr. Thompson first revealed this information, and it was Hooker, really, really an amazing man and hero and courageous figure, who basically got the whistleblower to turn himself in. And so I said, look, it seems like nobody in Congress wants this to happen. So here's why, and I really want the audience to understand this, because, you know, before I got into all of this, I would think, you know, we have a free press, we have a robust debate in the society about pretty much everything. Here's how bad this situation is. So everybody listening can say, oh, gee, we know the oil and gas industry has remarkable, you know, influence in our society and our political system. Well, the pharmaceutical industry spends twice as much on lobbying as the oil and gas industry. They have 1,500 lobbyists in Washington, D.C. So they basically have three lobbyists for every single congressman and senator. So imagine also they have complete immunity for vaccines, okay? It is an amazing cash cow for them. Okay, let's talk about the media. They spend $5.4 billion a year on advertising. Do they spend the bulk of those advertising dollars? On the nightly news. Robert Kennedy Jr. talks about how he approached Roger Ailes of Fox News. Roger Ailes has been a friend of Robert Kennedy Jr. from the time Robert Kennedy Jr. was 17 years old. And he said to him, Roger, let me on one of your shows. Nobody will let me talk about this. And Roger, even though Roger Ailes had seen the film Trace Amounts and was sympathetic to the issue, he said to Robert Kennedy, if I let you on, if any of you were on any one of my shows on Fox News, I would have to immediately fire the host, because in a non-election year, Fox News gets up to 70% of its advertising revenues from the pharmaceutical companies. So we are locked down. We are locked down legally. We are locked down politically. We are locked down in the media. That's how, you know, the odds we face. So God bless you, Dr. Selman, for having people like me on, because every other avenue is blocked to us.
Well, who's the most sympathetic person in Congress, do you think?
Jason Chaffetz, our people met with him last August for about an hour and a half. He seemed very sympathetic. I haven't heard anything happening. But we had, and then I just recently saw that he's retiring. So I don't know. And it's this terrible thing, because the system, this is the worst of all possible worlds. I mean, you know, I grew up a Catholic. I went to Catholic schools. I had the experience of wanting to become actually a Christian brother, even through college, I was considering it. And lo and behold, I find out that, you know, the Catholic high school that I went to was subject to a molestation case, and they seemed like they did some very bad things. And, you know, for a long time, I refused to believe it. I mean, I couldn't believe that these brothers who I looked up to had covered up a terrible molestation case. And I think it's that way, because you have this mix of, you know, these doctors telling you that this is the thing you should do, and they're being given bad information, but they also have responsibility because they're not scratching the surface and looking a little deeper. I mean, we have had so many doctors join our cause because they say to themselves, you know, I didn't believe you guys at first, but I started doing my own research, and it makes me sick. I just think we have to be loud. The other thing that we are very hopeful for, although it's very controversial, is that it seems like Robert Kennedy Jr. and Donald Trump have forged a partnership. And, you know, everybody heard Trump say at the Republican debate that was at the Reagan Library that he thinks that vaccines are linked to autism, and he thinks we're given too many of them, and we got to look at this. And, you know, he has been as good as his word. He actually I kind of broke the story with a picture that Andy Wakefield had sent me after the election, because Trump had met with Wakefield in August and some other autism activists. He actually took a copy of the film, Vax from Cover-Up to Catastrophe, promised that he would watch it, and he promised that there would be further conversations if he won. So then Trump turned around and made Kennedy head of the Vaccine or Safety Commission, or, you know, potentially he's going to be the head of this thing if it gets formed. So, you know, I always say this is not a Republican disease. This is not a Democratic disease. It's not an independent disease. It's just – it's a disease that affects everybody. This really is all hands on deck. So, you know, I'm kind of a science fiction fan, so, you know, I always love those movies where, you know, aliens attack the Earth and everybody joins together, and you kind of find that the differences that you thought you had, you know, when it comes down to defending the human race, everything kind of shrinks to insignificance. So, you know, I really don't care what somebody's political background is. If they're willing to fight this battle with me, they're my buddy. I mean, it was really disturbing to hear Kennedy talk about some things, because he said, you know, he tried to bring this up to Bernie Sanders, who I thought, you know, also was a chance of, you know, to be a fighter to shake up the system. And Bernie Sanders wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. And so I find myself really disappointed by the lack of courage by a number of people. And then, you know, they're the surprising people that you don't think will end up being your friends, and they do. And you know, even with all the other differences, you say, gee, you know, let's win this fight for humanity, and then we can, you know, break down and squabble about all the other things.
And it is a fight for humanity, because the statistics are really grim as you project them out into the future. As we keep increasing the number of vaccines in young children, and then, of course, there's the Gardasil vaccine that we're giving to, you know, 11 and 12-year-olds with devastating consequences. And I don't know whether you've heard anything about vaccines are going to be mandated for the entire population at some point. But in terms of the health consequences to children, I mean, the statistics are, what is it, by 2030, almost, what, one in two children will be diagnosed with autism? It's something
horrible. Yeah. So Dr. Stephanie Sinnott is a senior research scientist at MIT. So, you know, she's not some quack. She's a serious scientist. And she says, you know, look, if present trends continue, by 2032, one in two children will be on the spectrum. That's terrifying. You know, that really is an extinction level event. And we have to stop it. And so, you know, I will be the first to say that, you know, in the 15 years I've been an activist, I've come to realize that when I started out in this, you know, did I take the approach that, oh, geez, I just need to make sure the doctors take a look at this, and, oh, we want to be all on the same side, and, oh, we just want safe vaccines. And, you know, maybe that was appropriate given what we knew at the time, but what has really been so disturbing to me is to go through, you know, these documents that William Thompson has turned over and to say, you know, we used to think that the, you know, the scientists were just contemptuous of our ideas, but they believed that they were right. And what's terrifying to see is that they know that we are right, and none of them has the courage to stand up and say, this has got to stop. I mean, you know, and there is so much diversity among our community about what should be done. I mean, there's a really great doctor, Dr. Paul Thomas, out of Portland, Oregon, who's written a book called The Vaccine Friendly Plan. And what he says is he says, gee, you know, I think the problem in my practice of, you know, 14,000 patients, he's done a study, and he says, I just think if we don't get the hepatitis B shot on the first day of life, and we don't get the MMR until after three, and then we space out all the other vaccines, you know, in 1,000 patients, I don't have a single case of autism with that group. You know, but at the same time, he also says, I've got a smaller group of about 300 kids who've gotten absolutely no vaccines, and by every single measure, they are the safest, the healthiest group of anybody in my practice. So we need to get the information, but this is, you know, this is red alert time. And so, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, gee, be safe, be careful, think about it. I mean, we're looking potentially at the, you know, the end of human civilization. If we've got one out of every two people having autism, having all these terrible diseases, I mean, you know, I'm sorry, that's the end of civilization as we know it. We're going to have societal collapse. And, you know, I'm going to work as hard as I can to make sure that doesn't happen. Because I also think very strongly that if we turn this around, if we turn this around, meaning we actually did the science to find out what's going wrong, I think it's reversible. I want to end talking about the research of a guy named Dr. Robert Navio. He's from University of California, San Diego. And he's got a really interesting theory, and it's simple. And it's so simple that if we turned our society towards fixing this problem, I honestly think in 2 to 3 years, we could fix this thing. So what he thinks that vaccines do, and it could be any toxin, okay? So it could be, a lot of people will get hung up on mercury or the aluminum or the viruses, you know, whatever, polysorbate 80. But what he says is something really simple is happening in the body. The body is shutting down its communication system. He says there's an old pathway called the cell danger response. And what's happening is the cells just decide it's dangerous out there. Let's stop communicating, because that's a really good action for the body to take when there are toxins around, okay? You know, toxins get flushed out, you know. But he says what happens is the body gets stuck in not communicating. So all these weird things happen and development doesn't take place. Well, what he's done is he's used an animal model of autism. And how do you induce autism in experimental animals? You overstimulate the immune system of the mother while she's pregnant. Interesting, huh? Immune stimulation leads to autism. Wow, that sounds like a vaccine to me. And so what he's found is there's this old medication called Suramin, which was used to treat African sleeping sickness. And he says that using a dosage, which is only about like 1 to 10% of that that they used with African sleeping sickness, they were able to cure autism in animal models. Everything, their cells started communicating, and they were able to quantify it by measuring certain metabolites. And their behavior changed, and I've actually interviewed him, I've had dinner with him, and he basically says, look, so he's done it with mice who have autism, mice who have fragile X syndrome, which is often called genetic autism, but it's just because they're lacking a gene that basically calms the cells and tells them it's safe to communicate. He's also done it with mice who have the human age equivalent of 30 years old, and he gets pretty much exactly the same results. And so he has said that, you know, for somebody like my daughter, he says, I only think that I would need to do like an infusion every 6 to 8 weeks for a period of like 2 years. And then she should be fine on her own. And so we can cure this thing. We, you know, I'm interested in stopping it, but I'm interested in my daughter having something of a normal life where she's able to use the bathroom on her own, maybe go for a run, maybe have friends. And I totally think that is possible if we tell the truth about what's happened and we take appropriate measures. And see, I think that as much as it's been a tragedy what's happened to hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of children and their families, it doesn't have to be a perpetual tragedy. We can turn this into a boon for mankind, because I think the exact same thing is happening with people who have all these dementias in their old age, the Alzheimer's, the Parkinson's, all these things. Maybe, and this is just what Navio says, maybe what we're looking at is like the master switch. And, you know, we if we can fix that switch, maybe not only can we recover the autistic children, maybe we can also bring about a vital old age for the rest of the population too. And wouldn't that be a wonderful world to live in?
Well, that's uplifting and inspiring. Are you thinking of doing that infusion for your daughter?
You know, the problem is currently the medication was used in the 70s and 80s on AIDS patients, and the cancer doctors got a hold of it, and they gave really high doses, and then there were liver problems, so it's currently prohibited unless my daughter has African sleeping sickness. But I am hopeful that Dr. Navio will continue his research, and I'm hopeful that with the new administration that once cures and seems to have some appetite for addressing this, that maybe his research can be supported, because, you know, I think of all the problems we have in our society, all the sick people, all the cancer, all the childhood cancers. I mean, you think about it. Cancer really is just the body is not doing its job, and so these cancers develop. And we've got a good amount of data that suggests that vaccines are behind this huge increase in childhood cancers. So there is so much going on. And think about, like, to me, like, the fight over Obamacare is like a little issue to me. And I find myself saying, what if we had a dramatically healthier population? If we had a dramatically healthier population, the cost of healthcare would be so much lower. And then we could have these fights over who pays for health insurance. And, you know, it's 10% of the problem it is today. And so I don't care if there's a single payer. I don't care. I personally like the free market better. But, oh, my God, if we could be dramatically healthier as a species, you know, these would become insignificant problems. We would really have health care, not disease care that we have today.
Well, you know, I'm kind of speechless, actually, because You know, you've presented such a compelling story and evidence in your case against the vaccines. It's overwhelming. You know, we just all have to kind of stop, take a breath, and take it in, because it's so profound, goes so deep and so wide in our culture. We all have to really wake up. And, you know, we've come to the end of this fantastic conversation, but Ken, if you can just have like two sentences, if there's something you really want to say to people listening, what would you say to them right now?
I know this seems overwhelming. I encourage you to go and buy my book, Inoculated, How Science Lost Its Soul in Autism. My wife tells me it's a really easy read. So, I just lay it out. She jokingly said, this book is much easier to read than your first one. and it is, because really it's just the search for truth. And you know, I don't have an agenda besides telling the truth and trying to make the world a better place. That's it. So, you know, I'm not going to brainwash you. Read my book, you know, and come to your own conclusions. Tell me where I'm wrong, because, you know, I'm just trying to make the world a better place, and I know everybody else is, but we got to talk to each other, and we got to go to these dark places that we're afraid to go, because maybe in those dark places we're going to find the light that's going to help save the world.
Well, those are great last words, and I want everyone to visit your website, inoculated.org. That's inoculated.org. And definitely pick up a copy of Inoculated, How Science Lost Its Soul in Autism. Wake up, everyone, get the truth, and start on the path of really changing things profoundly. So, Kent Heckenlively, thank you so much for this time today. I so appreciate everything you've been doing in your research. So many of us out there are very grateful to you. And to all of you listening, thank you for joining me today for another opportunity to get empowered with truthful information. And as I always like to say, honor the wisdom of your feminine self. And bye for now.